act of rage and not its primary objective. The violent act, as I have observed it in other charges, is most frequently motivated by an excess of anger, and the outpouring of the anger is only incidentally damaging to people and property. Adeline's case does not fit this model. I've seen incidents myself, and been told of others, in which destruction seems to be Adeline's only motive, and rage something she has to tease out, stoke up in herself, in order to generate the energy to destroy. For she's a feeble little thing, skin and bone, and eats only crumbs. Mrs. Dunn has told me of one incident in the garden when Adeline is known to have damaged a number of ewes. If this is true, it's a great shame. The garden was clearly very beautiful. It could be put to rights, but John has lost heart over the matter, and it's not only the topiary, but the garden in general that suffers from his lack of interest. I will find the time and a way to restore his pride. It will do much to improve the appearance and the atmosphere of the house, if he can be made happy in his work, and the garden made orderly again. Talking of John and the garden reminds me I must speak to him about the boy. Walking about the schoolroom this afternoon, I happened to come near the window. It was raining, and I wanted to close the window so as not to let any more damp in. The window ledge on the inside is already crumbling away. If I hadn't been so close to the window, nose almost pressed to the glass, in fact, I doubt I'd have seen him. But there he was, a boy, crouching in the flower bed, weeding. He was wearing a pair of men's trousers, cut off at the ankle and held up with a pair of braces. A wide-brimmed hat cast his face in shadow, and I was unable to get a clear impression of his age, though he might have been 11 or 12. I know it is common practice in rural areas for children to engage in horticultural work, though I thought it was more commonly farm work they did. And I appreciate the advantages of their learning their trade early, but I do not like to see any child out of school during school hours. I will speak to John about it, and make sure he understands the boy must spend school hours in school. But to return to my subject. Where Adeline's viciousness to her sister is concerned, she might be surprised to know it, but I've seen it all before. Jealousy and anger between siblings is commonplace, and in twins, rivalries are frequently heightened. With time, I will be able to minimize the aggression, but in the meantime, constant vigilance is required to prevent Adeline hurting her sister, and this slows down progress on other fronts, which is a pity. Why Emmeline lets herself be beaten, and have her hair pulled out, and be chased by Adeline wielding the fire tongs in which she carries hot coals, I have yet to understand. She is twice the size of her sister, and could defend herself more vigorously than she does. Perhaps she flinches from inflicting hurt on her sister. She is an affectionate soul. My first judgment of Adeline in the early days was of a child who might not ever come to live as independent and normal a life as her sister, but who could be brought to a point of balance, of stability, and whose rages could be contained by the imposition of a strict routine. I did not expect ever to bring her to understanding. The task I foresaw was greater than for her sister, but I expected far less thanks for it, for it would seem less in the eyes of the world. But I have been startled into modifying that opinion by signs of a dark and clouded intelligence. This morning she came into the classroom dragging her feet, but without the worst displays of unwillingness, and once in her seat, rested her head on her arm just as I have seen before. I began the lesson. It was nothing more than the telling of a story, an adaptation I'd made for the purpose of the opening chapters of Jane Eyre, a story loved by a great many girls. I was concentrating on Emmeline, encouraging her to follow the story by animating it as much as possible. I gave one voice to the heroine, another to the aunt, yet another to the cousin, and I accompanied the storytelling with such gestures and expressions as seemed to illustrate the emotions of the characters. Emmeline did not take her eyes off me, and I was pleased with my effect. Out of the corner of my eye, I caught a movement. Adeline had turned her head in my direction. Still, her head rested on her arm, still her eyes appeared closed, yet I had the distinct impression she was listening to me. Even if the change of position was meaningless, and it was not, she had always turned away from me before, there is the alteration in the way she held herself. Where she normally slumps over her desk when she sleeps, in a state of animal unconsciousness, today her whole body seemed alert, the set of the shoulders, a certain tension, as if she was straining toward the story, yet still trying to give the impression of inert slumber. I didn't want her to see that I had noticed anything. I continued to look as if I was reading only to Emmeline. I maintained the animation of my face and voice, but all the time I was keeping an eye on Adeline. And she wasn't only listening. I caught a quiver of her lids. I had thought her eyes closed, but not at all. From between her lashes, she was watching me. It is a most interesting development, and one that I foresee will be the centrepin of my project here. Then the most unexpected thing happened. The doctor's face changed. Yes, changed, before my very eyes. It was one of those moments when a face comes suddenly into new focus, when the features, all recognizably as they were before, are prone to a dizzying shift and present themselves in an unexpected new light. I would like to know what it is in a human mind that causes the faces of those we know to shift and dance about like that. I've ruled out optical effects, phenomena related to light and so on, and have arrived at the conclusion that the explanation is rooted in the psychology of the onlooker. Anyway, the sudden movement and rearrangement of his facial features caused me to stare at him for a few moments, which must have seemed very strange to him. When his features had ceased their jumping about, there was something odd in his expression, too, something I could not, cannot, fathom. I do dislike what I cannot fathom. We stared at each other for a few seconds, each as awkward as the other. Then, rather abruptly, he left. I wish Mrs. Dunn would not move my books about. How many times shall I have to tell her that a book is not finished until it is finished? And if she must move it, why not put it back in the library whence it came? What is the point of leaving it on the staircase? I've had a curious conversation with John the gardener. He's a good worker, more cheerful now that his topiary is mending, and a helpful presence generally in the house. He drinks tea and chats in the kitchen with Mrs. Dunn. Sometimes I come across them talking in low voices, which makes me think she's not as deaf as she makes out. Were it not for her great age, I would imagine some love affair going on, but since that's out of the question, I'm at a loss to explain what their secret is. I taxed Mrs. Dunn with it, unhappily, because she and I have a friendly understanding about things for the most part. I think she approves of my presence here, not that it would make any difference if she didn't. And she told me that they talk of nothing but household matters, chickens to be killed, potatoes to be dug, and the like. "Why talk so low?" I insisted. And she told me it was not low at all, at least not particularly so. "But you don't hear me when I talk low," I said. And she answered that new voices are harder than the ones she's used to. And if she understands John when he talks low, it is because she's known his voice for many years and mine for only a couple of months. I'd forgotten all about the low voices in the kitchen until this new oddness with John. A few mornings ago I was taking a walk just before lunch in the garden when I saw again the boy who was weeding the flower bed beneath the schoolroom window. I glanced at my watch, and again it was in school hours. The boy didn't see me, for I was hidden by the trees. I watched him for a moment or two. He was not working at all, but scrawled across the lawn, engrossed in something on the grass right under his nose. He wore the same floppy hat as before. I stepped toward him, meaning to get his name and give him a lecture on the importance of education, but on seeing me he leaped to his feet, clamped his hat to his head with one hand, and sprinted away faster than I've ever seen anyone move before. His alarm is proof enough of his guilt. The boy knew perfectly well he should be at school. As he ran off, he appeared to have a book in his hand. I went to John and told him just what I thought. I told him I would not allow children to work for him in school hours, that it was wrong to upset their education just for the few pence they earn, and that if the parents did not accept that, I would go and see them myself. I told him, if it was so necessary to have further hands working on the garden, that I would see Mr. Angelfield and employ a man. I had already made this offer to get extra staff, both for the garden and the house, but John and Mrs. Dunn were both so against the idea, I thought it better to wait until I was more acquainted with the running of things here. John's response was to shake his head and deny all knowledge of the child. When I impressed upon him the evidence of my own eyes, he said it must be a village child just come wandering in, that it happened sometimes, and that he was not responsible for all the village truants who happened to be in the garden. I told him then that I had seen the child before, the day I arrived, and that the child was clearly working. He was tight-lipped, only repeated that he had no knowledge of a child, that anyone could weed his garden who wanted to, that there was no such child. I told John, with a little anger that I cannot regret, that I intended to speak to the schoolmistress about it, and that I would go directly to the parents and sort the matter out with them. He simply waved his hand, as if to say it was nothing to do with him, and I might do as I liked, and I certainly shall. I'm sure he knows who the boy is, and I'm shocked at his refusal to help me in my duty toward him. It seems out of character for him to be obstructive, but then I suppose he began his own apprenticeship as a child, and thought it never did him any harm. These attitudes are slow to die out in rural areas. I was engrossed in the diary. The barriers to legibility forced me to read slowly, puzzling out the difficulties, using all my experience, knowledge, and imagination to flesh out the ghost words. Yet the obstacles seemed not to impede me. On the contrary, the faded margins, the illegibilities, the blurred words, seemed to pulse with meaning, vividly alive. While I was reading in this absorbed fashion, in another part of my mind entirely, a decision was forming. When the train drew in at the station where I was to descend for my connection, I found my mind made up. I was not going home after all. I was going to Angelfield. The local line train to Banbury was too crowded with Christmas travellers to sit, and I never read standing up. With every jolt of the train, every jostle and stumble of my fellow passengers, I felt the rectangle of Hester's diary against my chest. I'd read only half of it. The rest could wait. "What happened to you, Hester?" I thought. "Where on earth did you go?" Demolishing the Past. The windows showed me his kitchen was empty, and when I walked back to the front of the cottage and knocked on the door, there was no answer. Might he have gone away? It was a time of year when people did go away, but they went to their families, surely, and so Aurelius, having no family, would stay here. Belatedly, the reason for Aurelius's absence occurred to me. He would be out delivering cakes for Christmas parties. Where else would a caterer be just before Christmas? I would have to come back later. I put the card I had bought through the mail slot and set off through the woods toward Angelfield House. It was cold, cold enough for snow. Beneath my feet the ground was frost hard, and above the sky was dangerously white. I walked briskly. With my scarf wrapped around my face as high as my nose, I soon warmed up. At the clearing, I stopped. In the distance, at the site, there was unusual activity. I frowned. What was going on? My camera was around my neck, beneath my coat. The cold crept in as I undid my buttons. Using my long lens, I watched. There was a police car on the drive. The builders' vehicles and machinery were all stationary, and the builders were standing in a loose cluster. They must have stopped working a little while ago, for they were slapping their hands together and stamping their feet to keep warm. Their hats were on the ground or else slung by the strap from their elbows. One man offered a pack of cigarettes. From time to time, one of them addressed a comment to the others, but there was no conversation. I tried to make out the expression on their unsmiling faces. Bored, worried, curious. They stood, turned away from the sight, facing the woods and my lens. But from time to time, one or another cast a glance over his shoulder to the scene behind them. Behind the group of men, a white tent had been erected to cover part of the site. The house was gone, but judging from the coach house, the gravel approach, the church, I guessed the tent was where the library had been. Beside it, one of their colleagues and a man I took to be their boss were in conversation with another pair of men. These were dressed, one in a suit and overcoat, the other in a police uniform. It was the boss who was speaking, rapidly, and with explanatory nods and shakes of the head. But when the man in the overcoat asked a question, it was the builder he addressed it to, and when he answered, all three men watched him intently. He seemed unaware of the cold. He spoke in short sentences. In his long and frequent pauses, the others didn't speak, but watched him with intense patience. At one point, he raised a finger in the direction of the machine and mimed its jaw of jagged teeth biting into the ground. At last, he gave a shrug, frowned, and drew his hand over his eyes, as though to wipe them clean of the image he had just conjured. A flap opened in the side of the white tent. A fifth man stepped out of it and joined the group. There was a brief, unsmiling conference, and at the end of it, the boss went over to his group of men and had a few words with them. They nodded, and as though what they had been told was entirely what they were expecting, began to gather together the hats and thermos flasks at their feet and make their way to the cars parked by the lodge gates. The policeman in uniform positioned himself at the entrance to the tent, back to the flap, and the other ushered the builder and his boss toward the police car. I lowered the camera slowly, but continued to gaze at the white tent. I knew the spot. I'd been there myself. I remembered the desolation of that desecrated library, the fallen bookshelves, the beams that had come crashing to the floor, my thrill of fear as I'd stumbled over burned and broken wood. There had been a body in that room, buried in scorched pages, with a bookcase for a coffin, a grave hidden and protected for decades by the beams that fell. I couldn't help the thought. I had been looking for someone, and now it appeared that someone had been found. The symmetry was irresistible. How not to make the connection? Yet Hester had left the year before, hadn't she? Why would she have come back? And then it struck me, and it was the very simplicity of the idea that made me think it might be true. What if Hester had never left at all? When I came to the edge of the woods, I saw the two blonde children coming disconsolately down the drive. They wobbled and stumbled as they walked. Beneath their feet, the ground was scarred with curving black channels, where the builder's heavy vehicles had gouged into the earth, and they weren't looking where they were going. Instead, they looked back over their shoulders in the direction they had come from. It was the girl who, losing her footing and almost falling, turned her head and saw me first. She stopped. When her brother saw me, he grew self-important with knowledge and spoke. "You can't go up there. The policeman said. You have to stay away." "I see."
"They've made a tent," the girl added shyly.
"I saw it," I told her. In the arch of the lodge gates, their mother appeared. She was slightly breathless. "Are you two all right? I saw a police car in the street." And then to me, "What's going on?" It was the girl who answered her.
"The policemen have made a tent. You're not allowed to go near. They said we have to go home."
The blonde woman raised her eyes to the sight, frowning at the white tent. "Isn't that what they do when..." She didn't complete her question in front of the children, but I knew what she meant. "I believe that is what has happened," I said. I saw her desire to draw her children close for reassurance, but she merely adjusted the boy's scarf and brushed her daughter's hair out of her eyes. "Come on," she told the children. It's too cold to be outdoors anyway. Let's go home and have cocoa. The children darted through the lodge gates and raced into the street. An invisible cord held them together, allowed them to swing around each other or dash in any direction, knowing the other would always be there, the length of the cord away. I watched them and felt a horrible absence by my side. Their mother lingered next to me. "You could do with some cocoa yourself, couldn't you? You're as white as a ghost." We fell into step, following the children. "My name's Margaret," I told her. "I'm a friend of Aurelius Love." She smiled. "I'm Karen. I look after the deer here. I know, Aurelius told me." Ahead of us, the girl lunged at her brother. He veered out of reach, running into the road to escape her. "Thomas Ambrose Proctor," my companion shouted out, "get back on the pavement." The name sent a jolt through me. "What did you say your son's name was?" The boy's mother turned to me curiously. "It's just... there was a man called Proctor who worked here years ago." "My father, Ambrose Proctor." I had to stop to think straight. "Ambrose Proctor, the boy who worked with John the Dig, he was your father?" "John the Dig? Do you mean John Digence?" "Yes. That's who got my father the job there. It was a long time before I was born, though. My father was in his 50s when I was born." Slowly I began walking again. "I'll accept that offer of cocoa if you don't mind. And I've got something to show you." I took my bookmark out of Hester's diary. Karen smiled the instant she set eyes on the photo. Her son's serious face, full of pride, beneath the brim of the helmet, his shoulders stiff, his back straight. "I remember the day he came home and said he'd put a yellow hat on. He'll be so pleased to have the picture." "Your employer, Miss March, has she ever seen Tom?" "Seen Tom? Of course not. There are two of them, you know, the Miss Marches. One of them is always a bit retarded, I understand, so it's the other one who runs the estate. Though she is a bit of a recluse. She hasn't been back to Angelfield since the fire. And I've never seen her. The only contact we have is through her solicitors." Karen stood at the stove, waiting for the milk to heat. Behind her, the view from the small window showed the garden, and beyond it, the fields where Adeline and Emmeline had once dragged Merrily's pram with the baby still in it. There could be few landscapes that had changed so little. I needed to be careful not to say too much. Karen gave no sign of knowing that her Miss March of Angelfield was the same woman as the Miss Winter whose books I'd spotted in the bookcase in the hall as I came in. "It's just that I work for the Angelfield family," I explained. "I'm writing about their childhood here. And when I was showing your employer some photos of the house, I got the impression she recognized him." "Well, she can't have. Unless..." She reached for the photograph and looked at it again, then called to her son in the next room. "Tom? Tom, bring that picture from the mantelpiece, will you? The one in the silver frame." Tom came in, carrying a photograph, his sister behind him. "Look," Karen said to him. "Lady has got a photograph of you." A smile of delighted surprise crept onto his face when he saw himself. "Can I keep it?" "Yes," I said. "Show Margaret the one of your granddad." He came around to my side of the table and held the framed picture out to me, shyly. It was an old photograph of a very young man, barely more than a boy. 18, perhaps, maybe younger. He was standing by a bench with clipped yew trees in the background. I recognized the setting instantly. The topiary garden. The boy had taken off his cap, was holding it in his hand, and in my mind's eye I saw the movement he'd made, sweeping his cap off with one hand and wiping his forehead against the forearm of the other. He was tilting his head back slightly, trying not to squint in the sun, and succeeding almost. His shirt sleeves were rolled up above the elbow, and the top button of his shirt was open, but the creases in his trousers were neatly pressed, and he had cleaned his heavy garden boots for the photo. Was he working there when they had the fire? Karin put the mugs of cocoa on the table, and the children came and sat to drink it. I think he might have gone to the army by then. He was away from Angelfield for a long time, nearly 15 years. I looked closely through the grainy age of the picture to the boy's face, struck by the similarity with his grandson. He looked nice. You know, he never spoke much about his early days. He was a reticent man. But there are things I wish I knew, like why he married so late. He was in his late 40s when he married my mother. Can't help thinking there must have been something in his past, a heartbreak, perhaps. But you don't think to ask those questions when you're a child, and by the time I had grown up, she shrugged sadly. He was a lovely man to have as a father, patient, kind. He'd always helped me with anything. And yet now I'm an adult, I sometimes have the feeling I never really knew him. There was another detail in the photograph that caught my eye. "What's this?" I asked. She leaned to look. "It's a bag, for carrying game, pheasants mainly. You can open it flat on the ground to lay them in, and then you fasten it up around them. I don't know why it's in the picture. He was never a gamekeeper, I'm sure. He used to bring the twins a rabbit or a pheasant when they wanted one," I said, and she looked pleased to have this fragment of her father's early life restored to her. I thought of Aurelius and his inheritance. The bag he'd been carried in was a game bag. Of course there was a feather in it. It was used for carrying pheasants. And I thought of the scrap of paper. "Something like an A at the beginning," I remembered Aurelius saying as he held the blur of blue up to the window. "And then an S, just here, toward the end. Of course it's faded a bit over the years. You have to look hard. But you can see it, can't you?" I hadn't been able to see it. But perhaps he really had. What if it was not his own name on the scrap of paper, but his father's? Ambrose. From Karin's house, I got a taxi to the solicitor's office in Banbury. I knew the address from the correspondence I'd exchanged with him relating to Hester. Now it was Hester again who took me to him. The receptionist didn't want to disturb Mr. Lomax when she learned I didn't have an appointment. "It is Christmas Eve, you know." But I insisted. "Tell him it's Margaret Lee, regarding Angelfield House and Miss March." With an air that said, "It will make no difference," she took the message into the office. When she came out, it was to tell me, rather reluctantly, to go straight in. The young Mr. Lomax was not very young at all. He was probably about the age the old Mr. Lomax was when the twins turned up at his office wanting money for John the Digg's funeral. He shook my hand, a curious gleam in his eye, a half-smile on his lips, and I understood that to him we were conspirators. For years he'd been the only person to know the other identity of his client, Miss March. He'd inherited the secret from his father along with the cherry desk, the filing cabinets, and the pictures on the wall. Now, after all the years of secrecy, there came another person who knew what he knew.
"Glad to meet you, Miss Lee. What can I do to help?"
"I've come from Angelfield, from the site. The police are there. They found a body."
"Oh. Oh, goodness."
"Will the police want to speak to Miss Winter, do you suppose?" At my mention of the name, his eyes flickered discreetly to the door, checking that we could not be overheard.
"They would want to speak to the owner of the property, as a matter of routine."
I thought so. I hurried on. "The thing is, not only is she ill, I suppose you know that," he nodded, "but also her sister is dying." He nodded gravely and didn't interrupt. "It would be better, given her fragility and the state of her sister's health,
if she didn't receive the news about the discovery too abruptly. She shouldn't hear it from a stranger, and she shouldn't be alone when the information reaches her. What do you suggest?
I can go back to Yorkshire today. If I can get to the station in the next hour, I can be there this evening. The police will have to come through you to contact her, won't they?
Yes, but I can delay things by a few hours. Enough time for you to get there. I can also drive you to the station, if you like.
At that moment, the telephone rang. We exchanged an anxious look as he picked it up.
Bones? I see. She is the owner of the property, yes. An elderly person, and in poor health. A sister, gravely ill. Some likelihood of an imminent bereavement. It might be better, given the circumstances. I happen to know of someone who is going there in person this very evening. Eminently trustworthy. Quite. Indeed. By all means.
He made a note on a pad and pushed it across the desk to me. A name and a telephone number.
He'd like you to telephone him when you get there to let him know how things stand with the lady. If she's able to, he will talk to her. If not, it can wait. The remains, it seems, are not recent. Now, what time is your train? We should be going.
Seeing that I was deep in thought, the not-so-very young Mr. Lomax drove in silence. Nevertheless, a quiet excitement seemed to be eating away at him, and eventually, turning into the road where the station was, he could contain himself no longer.
"The 13th tail," he said. "I don't suppose..."
"I wish I knew," I told him. "I'm sorry." He pulled a disappointed face. As the station loomed into sight, I asked a question of my own. "Do you happen to know Aurelius Love?"
"The caterer? Yes, I know him. The man's a culinary genius."
"How long have you known him?"
He answered without thinking. "Actually, I was at school with him."
And in the middle of the sentence, a curious quiver entered his voice, as though he'd just realized the implications of my inquiry. My next question didn't surprise him. "When did you learn that Miss March was Miss Winter? Was it when you took over your father's business?"
He swallowed. "No." Blinked. "It was before. I was still at school. She came to the house one day, to see my father. It was more private than the office. They had some business to sort out, and without going into confidential details, it became clear during the course of their conversation that Miss March and Miss Winter were the same person. I was not eavesdropping, you understand. That is to say, not deliberately. I was already under the dining-room table when they came in. There was a tablecloth that draped and made it into a sort of tent, you see. And I didn't want to embarrass my father by emerging suddenly, so I just stayed quiet."
"What was it Miss Winter had told me?"
"There can be no secrets in a house where there are children."
We'd come to a stop in front of the station, and the young Mr. Lomax turned his stricken eyes toward me.
"I told Aurelius. The day he told me he'd been found on the night of the fire. I told him that Miss Adeline Angelfield and Miss Vida Winter were one and the same person. I'm sorry."
"Don't worry about it. It doesn't matter now, anyway.
I only wondered." "Does she know I told Aurelius who she was?"
I thought about the letter Miss Winter had sent me right at the beginning, and about Aurelius in his brown suit, seeking the story of his origins. If she guessed, it was decades ago. If she knows, I think you can presume she doesn't care. The shadow cleared from his brow. "Thanks for the lift." And I ran for the train.
Hester's Diary 2. From the station I made a phone call to the bookshop. My father couldn't hide his disappointment when I told him I wouldn't be coming home.
"Your mother will be sorry," he said.
"Will she?"
"Of course she will."
"I have to go back. I think I might have found Hester."
"Where?"
"They've found bones at Angelfield."
"Bones?"
"One of the builders discovered them when he was excavating the library today."
"Gracious."
"They're bound to get in touch with Miss Winter to ask her about it, and her sister is dying. I can't leave her on her own up there. She needs me."
"I see."
His voice was serious. "Don't tell Mother," I warned him. "But Miss Winter and her sister are twins." He was silent. Then he just said,
"You will take care, won't you, Margaret?"
A quarter of an hour later, I'd settled into my seat next to the window and was taking Hester's diary out of my pocket. "I should like to understand a great deal more about optics. Sitting with Mrs. Dunn in the drawing-room, going over meal plans for the week, I caught sight of a sudden movement in the mirror. 'Emmeline!' I exclaimed, irritated, for she was not supposed to be in the house at all, but outside, getting her daily exercise and fresh air. It was my own mistake, of course, for I had only to look out of the window to see that she was outside, and her sister, too, playing nicely for once. What I had seen, caught a misleading glimpse of, to be precise, must have been a flash of sunlight come in the window and reflected in the mirror. On reflection, an unintended drollery. It is the psychology of seeing that caused my misapprehension, as much as any strangeness in the workings of the optical world. For being used to seeing the twins wandering about the house in places I would not expect them to be, and at times when I would expect them to be elsewhere, I've fallen into the habit of interpreting every movement out of the corner of my eye as evidence of their presence. Hence, a flash of sunlight reflected in a mirror presents itself in a very convincing manner to the mind as a girl in a white dress. To guard against errors such as this, one would have to teach oneself to view everything without preconception, to abandon all habitual modes of thought. There is much to be said in favour of such an attitude in principle. The freshness of mind, the virginal response to the world. So much science has at its root the ability to see afresh what has been seen and thought to be understood for centuries. However, in ordinary life, one cannot live by such principles. Imagine the time it would take if every aspect of experience had to be scrutinized afresh every minute of every day. No. In order to free ourselves from the mundane, it is essential that we delegate much of our interpretation of the world to that lower area of the mind that deals with the presumed, the assumed, the probable. Even though it sometimes leads us astray and causes us to misinterpret a flash of sunlight as a girl in a white dress, when these two things are as unlike as two things can be. Mrs. Dunn's mind does wander sometimes. I fear she took in very little of our conversation about meal plans, and we shall have to go over the whole thing again tomorrow. I have a little plan regarding my activities here, and the doctor. I have told him at great length of my belief that Adeline demonstrates a type of mental disturbance that I have neither encountered nor read about before. I mentioned the papers I've been reading about twins, and the associated developmental problems, and I saw his face approve my reading. I think he has a clearer understanding now of my abilities and talent. One book I spoke of he did not know, and I was able to give him a summary of the arguments and evidence in the book. I went on to point out the few significant inconsistencies that I'd noticed in it, and to suggest how, if it were my book, I would have altered my conclusions and recommendations. The doctor smiled at me at the end of my speech and said lightly, "Perhaps you should write your own book." This gave me exactly the opportunity I've been seeking for some time. I pointed out to him that the perfect case study for such a book was at hand here, in Angelfield House.
that I could devote a few hours every day to working on writing up my observations. I sketched out a number of trials and experiments that could be undertaken to test my hypothesis, and I touched briefly on the value that the finished book would have in the eyes of the medical establishment. After this, I lamented the fact that for all my experience, my formal qualifications are not grand enough to tempt a publisher. And finally, I confessed that as a woman, I was not entirely confident of being able to bring off such an ambitious project. A man, if only there was a man, intelligent and resourceful, sensitive and scientific, having access to my experience and my case study, would be sure to make a better job of it. And in such a manner, it was decided. We are to work together. I fear Miss Dunn is not well. I lock doors, and she opens them. I open curtains, and she closes them. And still my books will not stay in their place. She tries to avoid responsibility for her actions by maintaining that the house is haunted. Quite by chance, her talk of ghosts comes on the very day the book I am in the middle of reading has completely disappeared, only to be replaced by a novella by Henry James. I hardly suspect Mrs. Dunn of the substitution. She scarcely knows how to read herself, and is not given to practical jokes. Obviously, it was one of the girls. What makes it noteworthy is that a striking coincidence has made it a cleverer trick than they could have known. For the book is a rather silly story about a governess and two haunted children. I'm afraid that in it Mr. James exposes the extent of his ignorance. He knows little about children, and nothing at all about governesses. It is done. The experiment has begun. The separation was painful, and if I didn't know the good that is to come of it, I should have thought myself cruel for inflicting it upon them. Emmeline sobs fit to break her heart. How is it for Adeline? For she is the one who is to be the most altered by the experience of independent life. I shall know tomorrow, when we have our first meeting. There is no time for anything but research, but I've managed to do one additional useful thing. I fell into conversation today with the school teacher outside the post office. I told her that I'd spoken to John about the truant, and that she should come to me if the boy is absent again without reason. She says she is used to teaching half a class at harvest time, when the children go spud-hucking with their parents in the fields. But it's not harvest time, and the child was weeding the parterres, I told her. She asked me which child it was, and I felt foolish at not being able to tell her. The distinctive hat is no help at all in identifying him, since children do not wear hats in class. I could go back to John, but doubt he will give me more information than last time. I'm not writing my diary much lately. I find that after the writing late at night of the reports I prepare every day about Emmeline's progress, I'm frequently too tired to keep up with my own record of my activities. And I do want to keep a record of these days and weeks, for I am engaged with the doctor on very important research, and in years to come when I have gone away and left this place, I may wish to look back and remember. Perhaps my efforts with the doctor will open some door for me into further work of this kind, for I find the scientific and intellectual work more engrossing and more satisfying than anything I have ever done. This morning, for instance, Dr. Maudsley and I had the most stimulating conversation on the subject of Emmeline's use of pronouns. She is showing an ever greater inclination to speak to me, and her ability to communicate improves every day. Yet the one aspect of her speech that is resistant to development is the persistence of the first person plural. We went to the woods, she will say. And always I correct her. I went to the woods. Like a little parrot, she will repeat I after me, but in the very next sentence, we saw a kitten in the garden, or some such thing.
The doctor and I are much intrigued by this peculiarity. Is it simply an ingrained habit of speech, carried over from her twin language into English? A habit that will in time right itself? Or does the twinness go so deep in her that even in her language she's resistant to the idea of having a separate identity from that of her sister? I told the doctor about imaginary friends that so many disturbed children invent, and together we explored the implications of this. What if the child's dependence on her twin is so great that the separation causes a mental trauma, such that the damaged mind provides solace by the creation of an imaginary twin, a fantasy companion? We arrived at no satisfactory conclusion, but parted with the satisfaction of having located another area of future study, linguistics. What with Emmeline and the research and the general housekeeping that needs to be done, I find I'm sleeping too little, and despite my reserves of energy, which I maintain by a healthy diet and exercise, I can distinguish the symptoms of sleep deprivation. I irritate myself by putting things down and forgetting where I've left them. And when I pick up my book at night, my bookmark tells me that the previous night I must have turned the pages blindly, for I have no recollection at all of the events on the page or the one before. These small annoyances and my constant tiredness are the price I pay for the luxury of working alongside the doctor on our project. However, that's not what I wanted to write about. I meant to write about our work. Not our findings, which are documented thoroughly in our papers, but the pattern of our minds, the fluency with which we understand each other, the way in which our instant understanding permits us almost to do without words. When we are both engaged in plotting the changes in sleep patterns of our separate subjects, for instance, he may want to draw my attention to something, and he doesn't need to speak, for I can feel his eyes on me, his mind calling to me, and I raise my head from my work, quite ready for him to point out whatever it is. Skeptics might consider this pure coincidence, or suspect me of magnifying a chance incidence into a habitual occurrence by imagination, but I've come to see that when two people work closely together on a joint project, two intelligent people, I mean to say, a bond of communication develops between them that can enhance their work. All the while, they are jointly engaged on a task. They are aware of, acutely sensitive to, each other's tiniest movements, and can interpret them accordingly. This even without seeing the infinitesimal movement. And it is no distraction from the work. On the contrary, it enhances it, for our speed of understanding is quickened. Let me add one simple example, small in itself, but standing in for countless others. This morning, I was intent upon some notes, trying to see a pattern of behaviour emerging from his jottings on Adeline. Reaching for a pencil to make an annotation in the margin, I felt the doctor's hand brush mine, and he passed the pencil I sought into it. I looked up to thank him, but he was deeply engrossed in his own papers, quite unconscious of what had happened. In such a way we worked together, minds, hands, always in conjunction, always anticipating the other's needs and thoughts. And when we are apart, which we are for most of the day, we are always thinking of small details relating to the project, or else observations about the broader aspects of life and science, and even this shows how well suited we are for this joint undertaking. But I am sleepy, and though I could write at length of the joys of co-authoring a research paper, it is really time to go to bed. I have not written for nearly a week, and do not offer my usual excuses. My diary disappeared. I spoke to Emmeline about it, kindly, severely, with offers of chocolate and threats of punishment. And yes, my methods have broken down, but frankly, losing a diary touches one most personally. But she continues to deny everything. Her denials were consistent, and showed many signs of good faith. Anyone not knowing the circumstances would have believed her. Knowing her as I do, I found the theft unexpected myself, and find it hard to explain it within the general progress she has made. She cannot read, and has no interest in other people's thoughts and inner lives, other than so far as they affect her directly. Why should she want it? Presumably, it's the shine of the lock that tempted her. Her passion for shiny things is undiminished, and I don't try to reduce it. It is usually harmless enough. But I am disappointed in her. If I were to judge by her denials and her character alone, I would conclude that she was innocent of the theft. But the fact remains that it cannot have been anyone else. John? Mrs. Dunn? Even supposing that the servants should have wanted to steal my diary, which I don't believe for a minute, I remember clearly that they were busy elsewhere in the house when it went missing. In case I was wrong about this, I brought the conversation around to their activities, and John confirms that Mrs. Dunn was in the kitchen all morning, making a right racket, too, he told me. She confirms that John was at the coach house mending the car, noisy old job. It cannot have been either of them. And so, having eliminated all the other suspects, I am obliged to believe that it was Emmeline. And yet I cannot shake off my misgivings. Even now I can picture her face, so innocent in appearance, so distressed at being accused, and I'm forced to wonder, is there some additional factor at play here that I've failed to take into account? When I view the matter in this light, it gives rise to an uneasiness in me. I'm suddenly overwhelmed by the presentiment that none of my plans is destined to come to fruition. Something has been against me ever since I came to this house. Something that wants to thwart me and frustrate me in every project I undertake. I have checked and rechecked my thinking, retraced every step in my logic. I can find no flaw, yet still I find myself beset by doubt. What is it that I am failing to see? Reading over this last paragraph, I am struck by the most uncharacteristic lack of confidence in my tone. It is surely only tiredness that makes me think thus. An unrested mind is prone to wander into unfruitful avenues. It is nothing that a good night's sleep cannot cure. Besides, it's all over now. Here I am, writing in the missing diary. I locked Emmeline in her room for 4 hours. The next day for 6, and she knew the day after it would be 8. On the second day, shortly after I came down from unlocking her door, I found the diary on my desk in the schoolroom. She must have slipped down very quietly to put it there. I didn't see her go past the library door to the schoolroom, even though I left the door open deliberately. But it was returned, so there's no room for doubt, is there? I am so tired, and yet I cannot sleep. I hear steps in the night, but when I go to my door and look into the corridor, there's no one there. I confess it made me uneasy, makes me uneasy still, to think that this little book was out of my possession even for 2 days. The thought of another person reading my words is most discomforting. I cannot help but think how another person would interpret certain things I have written, for when I write for myself only, and know perfectly well the truth of what I write, I am perhaps less careful of my expression, and writing at speed may sometimes express myself in a way that could be misinterpreted by another who would not have my insight into what I really mean. Thinking over some of the things I have written, the doctor and the pencil, such an insignificant event, hardly worth writing about at all, really, I can see that they might appear to a stranger in a light rather different from what I intended, and I wonder whether I should tear out these pages and destroy them. Only I do not want to, for these are the pages that I most want to keep, to read later, when I'm old and gone from here, and think back to the happiness of my work and the challenge of our great project. Why should a scientific friendship not be a source of joy? It is no less scientific for that, is it? But perhaps the answer is to stop writing altogether. For when I do write, even now as I write this very sentence, this very word, I am aware of a ghost reader who leans over my shoulder, watching my pen, who twists my words and perverts my meaning, and makes me uncomfortable in the privacy of my own thoughts. It is very aggravating to be presented to oneself in a light so different from the familiar one, even when it is clearly a false light. I will not write any more. Endings. The Ghost in the Tale. Thoughtfully, I lifted my eyes from the final page of Hester's diary. A number of things had struck my attention as I'd been reading it, and now that I had finished, I had the leisure to consider them more methodically. Oh, I thought. Oh. And then... Oh! How to describe my eureka. It began as a stray what-if, a wild conjecture, an implausible notion. It was, well, not impossible, perhaps, but absurd. For a start... About to begin marshalling the sensible counter-arguments, I stopped dead in my tracks, for my mind, racing ahead of itself in a momentous act of premonition, had already submitted to this revised version of events. In a single moment, a moment of vertiginous kaleidoscopic bedazzlement, the story Miss Winter had told me unmade and remade itself. In every event identical, in every detail the same, yet entirely, profoundly different. Like those images that reveal a young bride if you hold the page one way, and an old crone if you hold it the other. Like the sheets of random dots that disguise teapots or clown faces or ruined cathedrals, if you can only learn to see them. The truth had been there all along. Only now had I seen it. There followed a long hour of musing. One element at a time, taking all the different angles separately, I reviewed everything I knew, everything I'd been told, and everything I discovered. Yes, I thought, and yes, again, that, and that too. My new knowledge blew life into the story. It began to breathe, and as it did so, it began to mend. The jagged edges smoothed themselves, the gaps filled themselves in. The missing parts were regenerated, puzzles explained themselves, and mysteries were mysteries no longer. At last, after all the tale-telling and all the yarn-spinning, after the smoke-screens and the trick-mirrors and the double bluffs, I knew. I knew what Hester saw that day when she thought she saw a ghost. I knew the identity of the boy in the garden. I knew who attacked Mrs. Maudsley with a violin. I knew who killed John the Dig. I knew who Emmeline was looking for underground. Details fell into place. Emmeline talking to herself behind a closed door when her sister was at the doctor's house. Jane Eyre, the book that appears and reappears in the story, like a silver thread in a tapestry. I understood the mysteries of Hester's wandering bookmark. The appearance of the turn of the screw, and the disappearance of her diary. I understood the strangeness of John the Dig's decision to teach the girl who had once desecrated his garden how to tend it. I understood the girl in the mist, and how and why she came out of it. I understood how it was that a girl like Adeline could melt away and leave Miss Winter in her place. "I'm going to tell you a story about twins," Miss Winter had called after me that first evening in the library, when I was on the verge of leaving. Words that, with their unexpected echo of my own story, attached me irresistibly to hers. "Once upon a time, there were two baby girls."
except that now I knew better. She had pointed me in the right direction that very first night. If I'd only known how to listen.
"Do you believe in ghosts, Miss Lee?"
she'd asked me.
"I'm going to tell you a ghost story."
And I had told her some other time. But she had told me a ghost story. Once upon a time, there were two baby girls. Or alternatively, once upon a time, there were three. Once upon a time, there was a house, and the house was haunted. The ghost was, in the usual way of ghosts, mostly invisible, and yet not quite invisible. There was the closing of doors that had been left open, and the opening of doors left shut. The flash of movement in a mirror that made you glance up. The shimmer of a draught behind a curtain when there was no window open. The little ghost was there in the unexpected movement of books from one room to another, and in the mysterious movement of bookmark from page to page. It was her hand that lifted a diary from one place and hid it in another. Her hand that replaced it later. If, as you turned into a corridor, the curious idea occurred to you that you had just missed seeing the sole of a shoe disappearing around the far corner, then the little ghost was not far away. And when, surprised by the back of the neck feeling as if someone has their eye on you, you raised your head to find the room empty, then you could be sure that the little ghost was hiding in the emptiness somewhere. Her presence could be divined in any number of ways by those who had eyes to see. Yet she was not seen. She haunted softly, on tiptoe, in bare feet. She made never a sound. And yet she recognized the footfall of every inhabitant of the house, knowing every creaking board and every squeaky door. Every dark corner of the house was familiar to her, every nook and every cranny. She knew the gaps behind cupboards and between sets of shelves. She knew the backs of sofas and the underneath of chairs. The house, to her mind, was 101 hiding places, and she knew how to move among them invisibly. Isabel and Charlie never saw the ghost. Living as they did, outside logic, outside reason, they were not the sort to be perplexed by the inexplicable. Losses and breakages and the mislaying of random items seemed to them part of the natural universe. A shadow that fell across a carpet where a shadow ought not to be didn't cause them to stop and reflect. Such mysteries seemed only a natural extension of the shadows in their hearts and minds. The little ghost was the movement in their peripheral vision, the unacknowledged puzzle in the back of their minds, the permanent shadow attached, without their knowing it, to their lives. She scavenged for leftovers in their pantry like a mouse, warmed herself at the embers of their fires after they'd gone to bed, disappeared into the recesses of their dilapidation the instant anyone appeared. She was the secret of the house. Like all secrets, she had her guardians. The housekeeper saw the little ghost as plain as day, despite her failing eyesight. A good thing, too. Without her collaboration, there would never have been enough scraps in the pantry, enough crumbs from the breakfast loaf to sustain the little ghost. For it would be a mistake to think that the ghost was one of those incorporeal, ethereal spectres. No. She had a stomach, and when it was empty, it had to be filled. But she earned her keep, for as much as she ate, she also provided. The other person who had the knack of seeing ghosts, you see, was the gardener, and he was glad of an extra pair of hands. She wore a wide-brimmed hat and an old pair of John's trousers, cut off at the ankle and held up with braces. And her haunting of the garden was fruitful. In the soil, potatoes grew swollen under her care. Above ground, the fruit bushes flourished. producing clusters of berries that her hands sought out under low leaves. Not only did she have a magic touch for fruit and vegetables, but the roses bloomed as they'd never bloomed before. Later, she learned the secret desire of Box and Yew to become geometry. At her bidding, leaves and branches grew corners and angles, curves and mathematically straight lines. In the garden and in the kitchen, the little ghost did not need to hide. The housekeeper and the gardener were her protectors, her guardians. They taught her the ways of the house and how to be safe in it. They fed her. They watched over her. When a stranger came to live in the house, with sharper eyes than most, with a desire to banish shadows and lock doors, they worried about her. More than anything else, they loved her. But where did she come from? What was her story? For ghosts don't appear at random. They come only to where they know they are at home. And the little ghost was at home in this house, at home in this family. Though she had no name, though she was no one, still the gardener and the housekeeper knew who she was, all right. Her story was written in her copper hair and her emerald eyes. For here is the most curious thing about the whole story. The ghost bore the most uncanny resemblance to the twins already living in the house. How else could she have lived there unsuspected for so long? Three girls with copper hair that fell in a mass down their backs. Three girls with striking emerald eyes. Odd, don't you think, the resemblance they both bore to the little ghost and she to them. "When I was born," Miss Winter told me, "I was no more than a subplot." So she began the story in which Isabel went to a picnic, met Roland, and eventually ran away to marry him, escaping her brother's dark, unbrotherly passion. Charlie